listener production.
Robin Sharma is considered to be one of the top five leadership experts in the world, mentoring billionaires, superstar athletes, and heads of state. He is well renowned for introducing the 5 a.m. club concept over 20 years ago that has changed millions of people's lives. Today, he returns for his third appearance on a Life of Greatness podcast. In the next hour, we discuss the life-altering system that will help you lead your richest life before it's too late. The framework based on the 8 hidden habits used by authentically rich people and the methodology to master your destiny.
Running your own race, trusting your own opinion. Instinct is so much more powerful than intellect. Trusting your instinct for that new business. You want to write that book and you want to move to a new place? Trust it. I think the only failure is the failure to try.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Through my years of studying and researching the connection between human behavior, personal growth, and transformation, I have discovered the keys to unlocking greatness within others. In this podcast, I share stories and experiences from my own teachings, along with conversations with inspiring guests to help you learn the simple tips, habits, practices, and strategies to cultivate an extraordinary existence. Robin Sharma is the author of many books, including The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, The 5 a.m. Club, and his newest book, The Wealth Money Can't Buy. At its core, this episode highlights the practical tools and transformational tactics for enjoying a genuinely rich life. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did recording it. There is so much to walk away from and put immediately into practice. Robin Sharma, what a delight to talk to you for the third time on the podcast. What have you been doing with yourself besides from writing?
Well, the past 12 months have been very much about writing. This new book has really consumed me and I put my heart and soul in it. I think I rewrote it 20 times. But, you know, I have a rich family life as well. So my family is deeply important to me. And my parents are in their mid-80s. So I'm blessed that they're still healthy and peaceful, but spending as much time as possible with them. And, you know, just doing more of the same, crisscrossing the planet, doing presentations, creating content online, and trying to serve the people who consume my content.
And tell me, you've decided to move to Italy, which is a wonderful thing because Italy is a beautiful country. What made you want to move there?
I lived in Toronto for many years. Almost 30 years, Sarah. I just think 30 years in any one place is enough time. Mm. And I like change. I'm not really particularly frightened by change. I actually thrive when there's change. And I just intuitively felt it was time to make a move and have a new adventure. So I packed up my bags and my partner, Elle, and I, along with our little 7-pound Chorky, I got on a plane and we started a new adventure. And I moved, as you say, to a new culture. I'm learning Italian, and it's a wonderful place, really wonderful people, and it's a great new adventure.
Wonderful.
And I wanted to beat winter as well. And I fell in love with Rome about 10 years ago. So I was going every 2 months or so. And I just thought it was time to make the move.
Wonderful. And as we said, you've got your new book, The Wealth Money Can't Buy, which is another fabulous read to add to your list of amazing, amazing books. But I feel like this is a book that is really needed at the moment because a lot of people are suffering inside and then that's being reflected on the outside. But you say so many people across the planet are suffering from thinking and feeling that they don't have enough. And you start the book by talking about the beautiful story about a boy who was watching the sunset over a house. If you could tell us a bit about that story.
Sure. Well, there was this young boy and he grew up seeing this magical home on a faraway hill. And as he grew up and got older, he said, one day I want to make the journey and visit this special place that looks like almost a small palace, a little jewel on the horizon. And when I get there, I'm going to find the place I need to be, and my heart will fill with peace and my soul will fill with joy and everything will be okay. So one day he decided to take the leap and he left where he lived. And he went to this place, and as he got closer, he realized it wasn't quite what he saw it was for so many years. And when he eventually arrived at this place, it was a broken down house. And it was just the way that the light fell that made the place look so special. And that's really how I wanted to start the Wealth Money Camp by, because society, Sarah, has sold us this idea that if we get more money, if we get more things, if we get more social media likes, if we get more applause, one day we're going to wake up with joy in our hearts and everything will be okay. And that's just not true. I mean, if you look at, there's a lot of billionaires, and I mentor many of them. I've done so for over 25 years. Many of these people are financially rich, but very, very poor in the other forms of wealth that I talk about in the book. And so you're right, there's a lot of good people and they're suffering. Like we're on this hedonic treadmill chasing these shiny toys only to find them and realize we just want more, and they don't give us the peace and the happiness and the health and the soulfulness that we all want.
Mm, I think it's interesting, that story that you use as well, because I think a lot of us look at people in the public eye or people that we think might have it all, and they're that shiny thing like the boy saw with the house. And then sometimes when you meet these people, you realize that they're only human and that everyone suffers. And sometimes our suffering can occur because we're looking at people like that and we're putting them on a pedestal, thinking that they have so much more than we have, to then meet them and realize that they absolutely do not. And it was a complete illusion the whole time. I just think that's a really interesting way, you know, once knowing that, then we might not look at people in the same light again, knowing that to an extent, if we don't do the work, then we suffer more.
Well, I think you identify a primary trap. We put these billionaires, these celebrities, these superstars on a pedestal, and we assume because they have a lot of money and they have fame, fortune, and applause, they're happy and they have it all. And yet I think of the great Zen proverb, wherever you go, there you are. I mean, you can get a bigger house, you can get more money, you can get millions of fly in a private jet or whatever it is, but you're still going to be you. And so it makes me think of Jim Carrey said, I wish everyone could be rich and famous to realize it doesn't make a difference. Mm. I think really it does make people suffer, because it makes us feel we're not enough, especially, and we've heard it a million times, but in this age of so much connection, constantly we're being pinged or we're scrolling and we're seeing these people living like that house, you know, these lives of great illusion, as if everything's happy. You know, I mean, no one shows, but most people show that their happy moments or the beautiful moments, or when they're in a great restaurant, let's say on social media. And often they don't show their struggles and what's going on in their soul and their insecurities and their pain. And we're all human. Mm. And we all have hopes and dreams and longings, and we all have insecurities and fears and difficulties. And so what I tried to do in the Wealth Money Camp by is what I've done is I've created this model that I've been teaching to my advisory clients for 15 years. It's called the 8 Forms of Wealth. Now, I'm not saying money is not important. There's actually 20 chapters, an entire section. One of the forms of wealth is money. And in those 20 chapters, I explain what I've learned from billionaires and how the super rich financially, how they do it, what are their mindsets, what are their habits, what are their strategies. But money is only one of the 8 forms of wealth. And so this model is and my hope is it'll show readers that there are many forms of wealth and it's a doorway into living a rich life. Mm. Because there really are a lot of people who have a lot of money, but they're very poor in other ways.
It's so true. And I think if you follow these different pillars, then you are able to attract more of that monetary wealth to you. But as you said, it's only one bit of a bigger story. Tell us what the the pillars are. Obviously, we're not going to go into every single one of them because unfortunately we don't have 5 hours and you need to buy the book to know all the different ins and outs. But tell us the headlines for what they are.
So the first form of wealth is growth. I mean, if you are in the process of mining your gifts and talents and getting to know who you truly are, you've got a form of wealth in your life. Mm. And most people might not see it as a form of wealth. Second form of wealth is wellness. So someone once said to me or shared a piece of paper with me at an event, and it said, health is the crown on the well person's head that only the ill person can see. Mm. Right? And if you have your health right now, you have a form of riches that money cannot buy. And just to spend a few more seconds on that, anyone who unfortunately has lost their health realizes nothing else matters but getting back your good health. Third form of wealth, family. If you have a rich family life, if you have connections with your family members, if you have great friendships, you have a source of wealth that you can't put a price tag on. Mm. And again, I've mentored so many financial titans, some of the world's richest people. And I will tell you, they say, I've got the yacht, I've got the houses, I've got the portfolio, I've got the jets, but my teenage kids won't even talk to me. Mm. And I mean, these people are heartbroken because of those lack of fundamental human connections. Fourth form of wealth is craft. So whatever you do, whether you are a barista, whether you're a taxi driver, yoga teacher, startup entrepreneur, if you see your work as a craft and if you are finding meaning in it and if you are a student of what you do and if you are delivering rich streams of value to the marketplace through your job, you have a form of wealth. I mean, this is year 30 that I've been writing these books and giving presentations and creating content. I feel I'm just getting started because I feel I have a sacred bond, a sacred form of trust with my readers. And so one of the great sources of riches in my life is the chance to create value and pursue a craft. The next form of wealth is money. It's financial wealth. Of course, we need to put food on the family table when you have money, enough money, and it's less than most people think. But then you don't get backed in a corner having to do things because you don't want to do them, but you need to pay the bills. Mm. And when you have financial resources, you can do great things for your family, you can have more freedom, and you can do things for people in need. The next form of wealth is community. So we become our conversations, the people around us. The seventh form of wealth is adventure. So if you are living a life of adventure, whether it's a trip, whether it's a new type of food, a new book, a new conversation, that's a form of wealth. And then the eighth form of wealth in the book, I call it service. Mm. And if we are using our lives to make the lives of other people better, we don't need to be a head of state or a financial CEO, but you have a form of riches that money can't buy.
That's beautiful. I want to talk about a quote that you use in the book, and it's from one of my favorite people, Rick Rubin. And he says, success occurs in the privacy of the soul, which is like worldly success without a joyful heart is fool's gold. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, I do believe that success without soulfulness is an empty victory. And I mean, how many times have all of us, all your listeners and viewers from around the world, we get something we always dreamed of getting, and we thought that would be the ticket and the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And we went, that was good. And we feel good for about a day. And then we go, it really didn't make a difference. Mm. And so does that mean that the hot pursuit of our ethical ambitions and worldly things is wrong? No, we're human. We're tribal. We all seek the good graces and the applause of others. We all want nice things or worldly success. I think that is part of what makes us human. And the wealth money can't buy doesn't make that wrong. But what I'm suggesting is, and it's an old idea, but be in the world, but not of it. Mm. In other words, you know, have a rich heart. In other words, enjoy the pleasures of the world. Maybe it's a good meal. Maybe it's a nice apartment or a nice house. but don't need those things. I'm going to repeat that again, if I may, Sarah. Enjoy the things, but don't need the things. Let material things and worldly success be your servant versus your God. And I think one of the most important forms of real wealth is peace of mind, peace of heart, peace of soul. If you can have serenity, if you can live in the world, but find this joyfulness and this peacefulness that comes, and we can talk about some of the tools, but that comes from that inner work and what I call MVP in the book, meditation, visualization, and prayer, time alone, writing in a journal, reading the books of wisdom, having a mentor. If you can develop that inner core, which is unshakable and peaceful, then you do have a wealth that money just can't buy.
It's so interesting that you talk about the MVP, meditation, visualization, and prayer, because they are not negotiable for me every single day. And, you know, I think some people would think I'm mad because I spend so much of my weekend doing long meditations and breath work. To me, it's become the most important, like one of the most important things in my life, because it sets my inner world alive, which allows me to then be there for everyone in my outer world. And if my inner world isn't strong, then it's very hard for me to show up and, you know, have these conversations and be there for my community and the people that need me. But also, I just love doing it. I love going into meditation every day. I love finishing doing my own prayers. I love within meditation doing visualization. And I think that when you do start to get into that stuff, you realize all those other things you were talking about, buying the handbag or whatever it is that may have given you joy before, they're still nice things to have. But as you said, you don't need them. Like, yeah, great. You get them and it's like, this is nice, but you don't have a need for them anymore. They don't make up who you are. It's the inner work that lays the foundations. So I'd love you to talk about that for yourself.
Well, you touch on a few key points. And there's the distinction between real power and fake power. Fake power is, oh, I've got the right shoes. I've got the right handbag. I'm in the right restaurant. I have the right title. Those things are fake power because they're easy to lose. We could lose the title. We could lose the material thing. Real power is the power a human being receives by moving through the layers of fear, doubt, and disbelief through the various tools that you've mentioned. I talk about hundreds of them in The Wealth Money Can't Buy, tools that really work to allow people to remember who they truly are. But that gives you true power. When you go through those layers of trauma, micro trauma and macro trauma that we all pick up as we go through life, we then become our egoic selves and we forget about our what I call our heroic selves. When you get back to who you truly are, and it doesn't happen in a day, it doesn't happen in a week, but steadily, each meditation, each journaling session, each prayer session, each mantra session, each nature walk, each reading period, they slowly and steadily move away the fake power and allow us to remember who we truly are. So I think it's very important. I'm also like you. People sometimes say, why would you get up at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. and meditate and pray and visualize? And you're absolutely right. The more you do it, after you get through the initial messiness and you wire in the morning routine as an automated habit, it's so joyful. It's so fun. And it dramatically affects the tone of the rest of your day. So when I don't do it, my day is so much less energetic and inspired. So I actually enjoy doing these methods because they just feel so good, as you're suggesting.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to point out as well, as I said, it's become such a habit for me now to wake up and meditate. I've been doing it for, I can't even remember how many years now. But I noticed if I did it like later in the day and not in the morning, I would wake up grumpy and then that would be my mood for a lot of the day. And I wonder for a lot of people out there, they might not even realize that's their normal. Like if they haven't gotten a good night's sleep or they've gone to sleep worrying about something and then they're waking up and they're like looking at their phone and seeing the emails or something that upsets them, they're not starting their day off right. And I know you speak about this, you know, within the 5 a.m. Club and a lot of your other books, but I just think it's so important to start the day with these good habits because that will be the rest of your day, you know, win the morning, win the day, that famous quote.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, we could get into the neuroscience behind it, but when you get up in the morning and you work out, you release dopamine, which will make you feel better. When you get up in the morning and you do some meditation, you'll release serotonin, which is the feel-good neurotransmitter. You'll release BDNF when you exercise first thing in the morning, which promotes neurogenesis, the formation of new brain cells, and allows you to process things better. But we live in a world where things are so busy, we forget to hear the signal. Mm. We live in a world where so few of us actually have any time in solitude. You know, and even if we're alone, we're checking our phones. So we don't, and it sounds so obvious, but so few of us have any time for ourselves. And so even when we're alone, we're always on or scrolling, and we never get to refill the cognitive well. We never really get to refill our inner lives. And what that starts to do over time is we really forget what's most important. And one of the worst things a human being can do, and I'm not judging, I'm just sharing, and this is just my humble opinion, but we don't want to spend our best hours climbing mountains each day only to find out at the end of a quarter or a year or a lifetime, we've climbed the wrong mountains. Mm. And that's what I'm trying to do with the 8 forms of wealth and the wealth money can't buy. Money, there's nothing wrong with making money. It's necessary. It is a metric of success, but we live in a world where our culture has programmed us to think that we are rich when we have a lot of money. Mm. I always find it interesting. You hear sometimes podcasters say, oh, we have an amazing guest because she's a billionaire. He's a billionaire. Well, that's fantastic. That takes a lot of achievement, et cetera. But what about the gardener with a great family life and high integrity and peace of mind who contributes to the community? Is that not a titan that we should also celebrate?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, you make that very obvious in your new book. One thing that I want to talk about is fear. And you say that fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. And that's obviously a quote within your book. Can you talk to us about that and how we overcome our fears?
Sure. So that's just to give credit where it's due, it's a quote from Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune. In the book, I talk about the Penham rule. And Penham stands for P, our parents, E, our environment, N, our nation, A, our associations, and M, the media. And it's an acronym that talks about the 5 forces that cause us to forget who we truly are. And so as we go through life, these 5 forces, our parents, for example, they give us the worldview that they grew up with. I mean, we are taught our fears. And so we adopt the fears of the people who taught us the way the world worked. So how do we move through our fears? Well, there are a few ways to do it. Number one, we've heard it a million times, but it is true. Set up scenarios that are uncomfortable. I mean, by doing the things we gave our power to, we take our power back. Mm. If we were afraid of public speaking, we've given our power to our fear of public speaking. How do you get the power back? You do the thing you're frightened to do. What I say in the book is hard is easy and easy is hard. When we do hard things consistently, we have an easy life. When we take the easy path, we end up having a hard life. So number one, doing difficult things. Number two, our associations are incredibly important. I mean, if you spend your time with energy vampires and dream stealers through the scientific phenomenon of emotional contagion, you will adopt their fears and start living a fear-based life. So spend time with people whose lives you want to be living. One of the chapters in The Wealth Money Can't Buy is set up a dead board of directors. So if you can't find live people whose lives you want to be living. Set up a dead board of directors. Read the books of Benjamin Franklin, Nelson Mandela, Hedy Lamarr, you know, the people who were in some ways fearless, whose lives we want to be living.
I think that's so true. And I want to talk about who you hang out with is who you become in a sense. Birds of a feather flock together. And, you know, I remember it was Tony Robbins saying that he, from a young age, always hung out with people that were smarter than him. And he didn't look at that from a jealous perspective. It actually fueled him to do better. And he loved it because the people that he was hanging about would make him think more and they'd have these amazing discussions. And that's what all made him thrive the way that he does. And I know that you've done a lot of research on that and how, rather than, you know, be jealous of someone or be envious of them, we should have a group of people around us that we can really, you know, have these great conversations with and that we could look up to and learn from each other.
One of the chapters speaks to the importance of actually, and it might sound simple, but all too often we look at people who we admire and it brings up jealousy. And if we could, rather than be jealous of someone who's doing better than we're doing, if we could celebrate them, and if we could just realize, wow, they've done something amazing, which gives me permission and an example for me to be amazing, I think we would have a lot less suffering in our lives and a lot more genuine success in our lives. There's a Harvard physician, and his name is Nicholas Christakis, on this power of association. And he's found something through his research I find very interesting, that we are influenced not just by our friends, our circle of friends, but we are influenced by the friends of our friends and the friends of our friends' friends. And again, it's why are we influenced to such a degree by three layers of the people around us? It's mirror neurons, a type of brain cell, which causes us to mimic the people we spend most of our time with. And secondly, emotional contagion, which is the phenomenon where over time we adopt the dominant emotions of the people in our social orbit.
Wow.
And so even social media, people that we follow, people we have conversations with, people at work, our friends, or even our families, all of these associations are affecting our mindsets, our emotions, our energy levels, our creativity, and the way that we live our lives. So the question then becomes, how do we release the energy vampires?
Yeah.
Because people often say, well, what if it's my mother? What if it's my husband or wife? What if it's my best friend who I've known for 20 years? And what I would say is, and it's an old idea, people come into our lives for a reason, season, or a lifetime. So sometimes we've had someone in our life for 20 years and it's just time to let them go. Mm. And how can you judge whether it's time to let them go? How do you feel when you're with them? Mm. I mean, there are a lot of people that good people allow into their lives that make them feel bad every time they're with them. Mm. So if they're, let's say, a mother or a close family member, I would say selective association rather than chatting with them every day, digitally or personally. Maybe it's once a week, maybe it's once a month. And secondly, love. Sometimes you have to let someone go and you never see them again. Doesn't mean you don't love them, but you love them from afar.
Mm. I wonder for yourself, obviously you're in the public eye and have been for a while now. How do you kind of deal with that with your own friends? And yeah, how have you built an inner circle that is not only beneficial for them, but yourself?
Wow, what a great question. I have a very small inner circle. It's mostly close family. I have a few very good friends who I've been friends with for a very long time. And I think the starting point is just, I'm really aware of if I'm with someone and when I'm with them, I just don't feel good. And when I leave them, I don't know if you know what I'm referring to, Sarah. I think you do.
I totally know what you
right?
mean. I totally know what you mean.
Right. And then they leave and you just have this bad feeling.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great sign that maybe this is not someone who is good for you. And it doesn't mean you just discard them instantly. Maybe it's worth a conversation. Maybe it's worth exploring what's going on. But I have a very small circle. I really tried to protect my inspiration. So I spend a lot of time at the farmhouse. It's an old farmhouse, but it's me and Elle, my life partner, and our little dog. Like I say, my children are older now. So, but I spent a lot of time with them. So it's, and family. And I'm just really careful about the influences that I allow into my orbit, even if it's videos that I watch or books that I read or conversations that I have. I'm just really careful because, like everyone watching, I'm a creative. And you can't create inspiration and you can't do your best work if you're de-inspired. And I think it's really important for us, especially in this perma-crisis or poly-crisis world, for us to live our lives in a little bit of a bubble. And that might sound unrealistic. I think it's important to protect our creativity and our gifts and our talents.
I absolutely agree. And I think if you don't have that much time, as well as a lot of us don't, because we're very busy doing, you know, you might have kids or you'd be working or writing or whatever it is that you're doing. And the time that you have, you want to spend it with people that you feel good around and that you're able to do the same for. So I think having a small inner circle as we grow older is, I found it for myself as well. And I think it's good because I feel like I can trust the people in there and we, you know, all lift each other up and we're there for the good times as well as the bad times, not just one of them. So yeah, I think that's really great hearing how you kind of manage that within your own life. Something that you spoke about earlier was family being obviously an important pillar. And it's interesting because it made me think of a friend of mine who deals a lot with the dying. And he said to me many years ago, he said, Sarah, you know, when people are on their deathbed, you know who the people are there? A couple of family members usually. They're the last ones there holding their hand. He said, it's not a lot of the time the friends, it's the family. So it's those people that really, like, if you can, like, you have to keep close. And when I read this in your book of being like such a key pillar, I'd love to know why you believe that too and made it a part of having kind of a wealthy life.
Elle's grandmother is going to be celebrating her 95th birthday in about a month. And when she was 90, we had a big party for her. And I found a few moments at this party and we sat together and I asked her, I said, you know, Nona, you're 90 years old. What do you believe is most important in life? Because any chance I get to sit next to an elder, I love it because they've learned a lot. So she thought about it and then she said, Robin, family. Family is the most important. So yeah, it's the second form of wealth because I've seen so many people build great businesses, build financial fortunes, become rich and famous in the world, but they're all alone. And what's the point? There's one chapter in The Wealth Money Can't Buy about, you know, don't be the person who's right, that client that I had.
Yeah.
You know, I was there to mentor him and it was the largest, most beautiful house I've ever seen. I walked past his art gallery and I walked, you know, to this underground office and there he was, but he was all alone. And he had what the world would perceive as everything. And yet he really had nothing. And then I've met people who might not have a lot of material things. I mean, some of the richest people I've ever met are ski instructors. And they say, I don't have a lot of money, but we have a rich life. It's one of the things ski instructors say. And many of these people, they ski all day, but they have great family lives. So I just think, you know, being connected to your family, especially if you have children and having love in your life, I guess that's what I'm really trying to say. I mean, can't put a price tag on having people who love you and having people that you love. I mean, few things are more valuable than that. You can have, you know, a multi-billion dollar portfolio, but if you don't have people who love you and if you don't have people to love, well, then you're going to be very empty inside. And what's the point of all the financial wealth?
Absolutely. And I want to touch on health because what you said before is so true about how we only realize that health is important a lot of the time when we don't have it. And that the people that are listening now who don't have their health, would understand that, and that we kind of take it for granted till it's not there anymore. And I'd love you to talk to that, because it is something that we should think about more and not something that we should take for granted. And something, I remember I did this meditation one day and it was guided, and it said at the end, you know, give gratitude to your body that's taken you from, you know, when you came onto this earth till now. And it was a moment of reflecting, and I did in the meditation, and thought, I am so grateful for this vehicle that I'm in, being my body, that it's like, you know, I can be annoyed at it at times here and there, but really it's done nothing and it's only served me. And I'd love you to talk to that.
I would say a few things. The DNA of legendary is longevity. So asking yourself, how can I extend my life by another 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years is a really smart move for any entrepreneur, any creative person, any human being. Because if you get to live longer, then you can help more people, you can have more fun, you can create more value. Imagine how good you'll be at your craft if you have another 30 years of practice. So I think health is important, obviously, to extend your life. I think taking care of your health and getting into the fittest you could possibly be is essential for energy. And energy is in many ways at the foundation of all achievement, but also a happy life. If you don't have any energy, you can't get anything done. You can't get out of bed. Also, in terms of financial wealth, the more energy you have, the more productivity you will have. The more productivity you will have, the more value you will create. The more value you'll create, the more income you'll have. And I think just feeling good in your skin is really a very important thing. So I talk about, there's chapters on, one of the chapters is the naked sunbathing rule. I talk about fasting in the book. I talk about, you know, the way you show up in the gym is the way you show up in life. So I think health is important. It makes me think of an old proverb: when we are young, we would sacrifice our health for wealth. And when we get old and figure out what life is all about, we would sacrifice all of our financial wealth for a day of good health.
It's interesting, because people might be thinking to themselves, like, oh, I don't have time for this. Like, I got to get up, I got to pray, I got to meditate, I got to journal, I got to do exercise. But what I love is that you've sat there with the billionaires and the people that are wealthy, not just from a money perspective, as we said, but they're just wealthy all over. Tell me, how do they fit it in? Because I feel like where there's a will, there's a way. And if you want to do it, you'll do it. Because a lot of the time people make excuses to me that they can't, but they seem to be prioritizing other things that maybe we would look at as being not as beneficial for their health and well-being.
Let's not confuse busy with productivity.
Yes.
And let's not confuse movement with progress. So there are so many people who are busy being busy, but the question is, what are we so busy with?
Yeah.
So how do the people who create truly rich lives do it? Well, they're minimalists. They are really, really good at just doing a few things. And it's true. If you look at many people, and I'm not judging, I'm just reporting, but there are many people who are addicted to distraction. They're addicted to busy. But if you ask, are you doing something that is a priority, that is adding value to your life, adding value to your hours? They're not. But they're just not aware of where their hours are going. And obviously, we've heard about it so much, but how many hours a day on television? How many hours a day on social media? How many hours a day watching videos? And it has become this great addiction for so many people, because I think deep inside, so many people are just overwhelmed. So many people are in pain, in the pain of potential unexpressed. And rather than feeling the pain and sitting with it and releasing it, it's easier to escape into these shiny digital toys that actually only make us feel worse. And so how do people who create truly wealthy lives do it? They get really, really clear on their values. They get really, really clear on the best uses of their time. And they become, Sarah, they become masters of the polite no. And they say no to too much phone time or screen time. They say no to social obligations that just cause them to drink more or perhaps eat more or waste their time. They say no to once in a lifetime business opportunities that are not aligned with their mission. And so they simplify their lives. They are not about complexity. They're all about simplicity. And they understand that these things that we're talking about, you know, whether it's meditation, whether it's prayer, whether it's being in a mastermind, whether it's doing an online course, whether it's listening to audiobooks, all these different tools, whether it's healing, whether it's a sweat lodge, whether it's acupuncture, whether it's Reiki, all these kinds of healing modalities, the best of the best realize that everything you touch and create in the outer world reflects what's going on within you. And so personal growth, as you call it, or as it's known, personal development is not a waste of time. It's the best way to spend your life because your income, your impact, your creativity is all reflecting what's going on within you. Quick example. I mean, I wrote The Wealth Money Can't Buy with deep devotion and love for my readers. And I worked the past 12 months or, you know, I worked 12 months on the book and it was just an absolute devotion. If I didn't have love and devotion for my readers, and I have a long way to go. I'm not saying I'm some kind of a guru, but you know, I'm doing it to be of service and to help people. And that has come from a lot of inner work. And so what I'm trying to say, probably not very elegantly, is because of the inner work that I've done, it's going to be reflected in the work that I'm doing. Mm. And so inner work and personal development is reflected in your work, in the way you deal with people, talk to strangers. It's the best work anyone could possibly do.
I absolutely agree because it's the way I live my life. And it's funny when you say that about where you put your money and like what you spend your time doing. I was talking to a girlfriend the other day and we were laughing because we were saying, all our money is going towards buying books, doing retreats, going to healers, doing this, doing that. And I'm like, people would think we were mad. Whilst most people our age are like buying all these other fancy things, we're putting it all onto personal development, but we wouldn't have it any other way because as we're saying throughout this discussion, once you've got your inner world worked out, it's a reflection of your outer world. And if you want to talk about the law of reciprocity, kind of like, you know, which is a bit different, what you put out, you receive. But I believe that from doing the inner work, that is the same. How you show up, how you're talking to people, you write about that in your book, like why, from a money perspective, why the way that we use language is so important. When you do this inner work, abundance will come your way, which is basically the crux of everything that you write about. But I would like to talk about that as far as like language is concerned when we're actually talking about money.
I'd love to answer that. One thing I wanted to mention as well, and you hinted at it, which is I deeply believe that people can feel quality. So if you are doing your work, whether it's coding, writing a book, a screenplay, building an app, if you are doing it solely for the money, then your focus and your energy is off creating the magic that will actually make you the money. And Steve Jobs was a master of this. You know, he was an artist in so many ways. He just wanted to push beautiful things into the world that make people's lives better. So people, whatever product you put out in the world, people feel the quality. So how do you get to a place where you are absolutely obsessed with pushing quality? It's from the inner work. Mm-hmm. You use the different modalities that are out there and you turn down the voice of the ego, which is selfish and coming from scarcity. And you actually say, wow, I'm going to shift from scarcity to generosity. I'm going to give, if maybe you run a restaurant, I'm going to give, create a beautiful space and the food is going to be so fresh and it's going to be skillfully prepared. And I'm going to train my team and create a culture where people are wowed by the service and the humanity that they receive. Well, that all comes from an entrepreneur, let's say, or a leader that really is devoted to love and service. And that comes from the inner work. So inner work absolutely is incredibly important in everything that we're doing. Yes, words are very, very important. There's a chapter in The Wealth Money Can't Buy about the importance of wealth words. I think we live in an age where a lot of people are using words of low energy, words which pollute which are toxic words. Mm. And these words, every word has such power. If you look at the people who freed nations, I think about Mahatma Gandhi. I think about Martin Luther King Jr. I think about Nelson Mandela. I think about, you know, Mother Teresa. These people used words that electrified their followers. That's how powerful the words are. I mean, the great movement makers didn't do so physically. They did it through the power of their words. Mm. And so words are incredibly powerful. If you want to create not only financial wealth, but a rich life and your richest life, then I think it's really important to clean out the toxic words from our vocabulary. And in the book, I've actually listed, I think, about 30 or 40 of the words of possibility, because I think all of us need to be possibilitarians. It's a really negative world out there. You know, I mean, if you look at the wars and you look at the climate situation and you look at the social polarity, I mean, talk about all the social divisiveness. That's often about words, words of hate versus words of understanding. And so I think we can, Mother Teresa said it well. She said, if we could only clean our own doorstep, the whole world would be clean. Mm. So how do we get a better world? A world of more understanding, a world of more goodness, a world of more possibility, a world of more magic. One of the ways is we use better words. We use the words of kindness. We use the words of can versus can't. Mm. We use the words of possibility. We use the words of abundance and generosity.
I love it within kind of the wealth chapter, you speak also about, well, there's all wealth, but the money chapter, you speak about having a solution mindset rather than a mindset of saying like, I can't do this. And that a lot of the people that you found that were very abundant had this kind of mindset. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
You can spot a victim a mile away because they're all about problems. Here's why I can't get promoted. Here's why I can't join the 5 a.m. club. Here's why this wouldn't work for me. Here's why I can't find love. Here's why I can't create my richest life. And if you recite your excuses long enough, you actually hypnotize and mesmerize yourself to believe they're true. People who are living their finest lives are not about excuses and they're not about problems. They're all about solutions. And I know that sounds really simple, but when I mentor billionaires and the CEOs and the titans, every time the marketplace throws a problem, they always ask themselves, what's the secret gift here? Every time they have a personal problem, they say, I'll roll up my sleeves. There must be an even greater benefit in this difficulty. And they practice being a master of finding solutions so often, it just becomes their default. They lose their biggest client. They say, fine, one door closes, another opens. There must be something great here. They have a health problem. They say, okay, I'm going to find a solution. I'm going to biohack. I'm going to find the right doctor. I'm going to try maybe another type of medicine, alternative medicine, or a new habit. And I'm going to become even healthier than I was before I dealt with the challenge. And so I think people who are truly successful and people who live great lives understand that a problem is nothing more than, what I'd say is every problem is actually possibility in wolf's clothing. Mm-hmm. And I've learned, and I'm almost 60, I've learned that life shows up for our fortune, not for our failure. Mm-hmm. And as we look back at every so-called problem, even every so-called tragedy, in the passage of time, we look back and we say, wow, I see how beautiful that was. And I see the how helpful it was for me to get to where I now am, even though in the moment it looked like this huge problem.
I love that. When we have faith that if, again, we're doing that inner work, that we're always going to be guided in the right direction, then having those kind of solution mindsets, it becomes second nature. And I think one of the things as well that I've learned in my own life is, obviously they say worrying is the thing that takes away any happiness in the present. But I think that it allows us to stop worrying about the what ifs or things that we can't control in our life and know that there will always be a reason behind why something has happened. And like you said, it might seem like a hardship at that moment, But when we reflect back on our life, we'll realize that it moved us in a different direction, which ended up working for us in the long run, which I think is if we go in with that mindset, it makes a lot of these situations that can seem unnerving a lot easier.
You know, I think the root of all fear and all worrying comes down to one thing, and all of us suffer from it. It's the background noise of death. I think at the deepest level, all of us have this background ambient noise coming from the fear of death. And if we can make peace, and I know it might sound a little dark, but if we can make peace with the fact that we're going to die, I think we'd really start to live. And we'd stop judging. I mean, why do we run from a tragedy and cling to a good time? It's because we are judging the problem, the divorce, the loss of a job or whatever. We're judging it as wrong. Now, a lot of people might say, Robin, you're not being practical. But I actually believe that the great spiritual masters, whether they're in the darkness of the valley or on the top of the mountain, they're still at peace. Because they are in the world, they're not of the world. And they've made peace with death. And they understand that death is, you know, in the book before this new one, the Everyday Hero Manifesto, there was a chapter called Death is Just a Hotel Room Upgrade. You know, and that's personally what I believe. Like, life is great right now, but when we die, we go to a place with, you know, even better coffee, a better place, et cetera. So why would we fear it? So I really think that if we're in a hard time, rather than running away from it, as our culture says, stay in the hard time. Make peace with the hard time. Learn the gifts of wisdom from the hard time. Learn how strong you are from the hard time. And this might sound so counterintuitive and weird, but stay in the hard time, because pain purifies us. Hard times introduce us to who we truly are. We learn very little from times in the sunshine. We learn so much about who we truly are when we're going through difficulty. I think happiness is, this might sound strange, but I think happiness is overrated.
Yes, I agree. Robin, what is the best advice, and might be recent, that you've ever been given?
Best advice I've ever been given? Well, I would just say, when I was in my early 20s, I had a mentor, and we were walking along the ocean side, and he shared with me, Robin, run your own race. And I think in this world right now, where we are so attracted to comparison, where we have so many images, like probably hundreds, if not thousands of images every day, where we compare ourselves to other people's lives, running your own race, trusting your own opinion. Instinct is so much more powerful than intellect. Trusting your instinct for that new business, that new relationship, that new move. Instinct is so powerful. That's the voice of our wisdom. It's not metaphysical, it's just natural. So I think just trusting yourself, and related to that, be careless about the opinions of other people. Because everyone has an opinion. Often it's coming from fear and scarcity and a lack of possibility. Just don't, you know, you want to write that book, you want to start that workout routine, you want to move to a new place, trust it. Trust it. I think the only failure is the failure to try.
What's something that you wish for yourself?
I'd like to have more of an impact, more, you know, serve more people. Yeah, I think right now a lot of people really are struggling with cost of living, a very uncertain world. The pundits, the macroeconomic pundits, are saying this is the most dangerous world in 100 years. And I would just like to do my part to help more people through my books and videos and presentations and doing what I do.
What's your favorite prayer or saying or mantra?
Well, one of them is, if I'm facing, let's call it a wound or a weakness I want to work through, it's, you know, I'll pray and I'll say, help me move through this. in a way that is joyful and easy and move into the love, the radiant love that I am. So that's a very helpful prayer to me too. I mean, every prayer is heard. Mm. And often it's easy to forget that that is a very powerful tool. And if you're not religious, then do scientific prayer, because science has confirmed that prayer really helps us get through difficulty. It makes us resilient. It creates positive psychology. So praying is a very powerful morning routine or pre-sleep ritual.
Mm. What is a life of greatness to you?
So I have a fresh answer this time, and it is living the wealth money can't buy. And I think a life of greatness really does involve the eight forms of wealth that I talk about in the book. I mean, that's really, I think our current cultural definition of success is causing a lot of people to feel empty, a lot of people to suffer, and a lot of people to feel very unworthy because they don't have tons of money. And if we could only work on the eight forms of wealth and define success and wealth and our richest life under these eight forms of wealth that include personal growth and family and adventure, for example, and seeing our job as our craft, then we would realize that we have a lot more wealth in our lives than we're actually acknowledging. And I think we'd find true wealth that that makes us feel a lot better about our lives.
Robin Sharma, you are a wealth of knowledge and wisdom. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. Your new book is fantastic. So thank you so much for the conversation today.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure, Sarah. Congratulations on the amazing success of your podcast. I've seen it flourish to such a degree. And it's thank you for having me on your show.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Your Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my manifestation course and meditations, head to the shop tab at saragrimberg.com or this week's episode show notes to find a link. If you love what you heard, we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others.